Now I ask Uncle Brian to address us to the subject, Thine Eyes Shall See the King in His Beauty.
Thank you.
Thanks, Brother Sim, and my beloved brethren and sisters and young people. It's rather apt that tonight we are looking at what is one of the key chapters in the story of Jerusalem. Because in our paper this morning, you may have noticed that the Prime Minister of Israel has put his foot down and he said, enough is enough. And we are going to build around Jerusalem and we don't care what anybody thinks. We will be persuaded against it by no opinion. And he said furthermore that Mr. Clinton, who had in the same 24 hours made comments about Israel should not build those settlements in East Jerusalem. East Jerusalem is just another word for the old city, what we would call Jerusalem. He made statements that Israel should not go ahead with settlements in that area. Now what an incredible front the world has, my dear brothers and sisters. When you think what God has done with that people, what a front those nations have got. What's Jerusalem got to do with Clinton? Now, ever, or in the future? Absolutely nothing. All he'll get from Jerusalem is judgment, a man like that. And yet he's telling the Jewish people, children of Abraham, they should not build in their own capital city. And Netanyahu's reply was, it's been our capital city for 3,000 years. We will not be listening to the advice of anyone. You know, when you really look at what Israel has got, Nazareth is completely occupied by Arabs. It's like an Arab city. What would be their next place? Bethlehem, that's an Arab city. It's part of the West Bank, already been given over. They celebrated, the Arabs, their vindication of the West Bank in Bethlehem just last year. Hebron's been given back, the place where their fathers are buried. And now they want Jerusalem. And the Arabs are kicking up a storm today. They were not at their places of work. The place was in a state of siege and strike all through Gaza and the West Bank. Because they are saying, that place, Jerusalem, belongs to us. Now, isn't that remarkable, my dear brothers and sisters? Isn't that a remarkable thing? That in our generation, having watched all that we have in our fathers before us, since the Jews began to trickle back in 1865, it's now come to this tremendous climax where Israel got back and they've prospered and multiplied and the world knows they are there, but they can't put their foot on Jerusalem. You know, we used to say, didn't we, Luke 21:24, that Jerusalem shall be trodden down of the Gentiles until the times of the Gentiles are fulfilled. That was completed in 67. Because in 67, the Jews put their own mayor in Jerusalem. We used to say, oh, well, that's the end of the times of the Gentiles. Makes you wonder, doesn't it? Makes you wonder. When you've got President Clinton against you, the US, when you've got all of Europe against you on that issue, when you've got all your neighbours and most of the rest of the world against you on that issue, when there's only, I think, two countries that have ever put their embassy in Israel, in Jerusalem. Makes you wonder, doesn't it? If Israel's going to be able to hold on to that as their undivided and indivisible capital city. That was their statement in the glorious days just following the Six-Day War, wasn't it? They went to the wall and the Prime Minister said, Jerusalem is the undivided and indivisible eternal city. Capital city of Israel. Remarkable things. We read tonight about, look upon Zion, the city of our solemnities. Thine eyes shall see Jerusalem, a quiet habitation, a tabernacle that shall not be taken down, not one of the stakes thereof shall ever be removed, neither shall any of the cords thereof be broken. You know, President Clinton, my dear brothers and sisters, can make up his mind whether he wants to live in Washington or not, but for him to be telling Jewish people, children of literal children of Abraham, they cannot live in Jerusalem, is no point of his arbitration whatsoever. Remarkable days. Now it came last time in our study to around about verse 7 or 8, We saw that very beautiful, that exceptionally beautiful description in verses 5 and 6 of Yahweh as king in a city of judgment and righteousness. He was exalted, verse 5. He dwelled on high. It's a lofty and majestic reign. He filled Zion with judgment and righteousness. It's not just a little trickle of decency here and there. He hath filled Zion with judgment and righteousness. The whole place loves it. Loves judgment. Loves righteousness. And it will flow out from the height of Zion to all peoples over whom it has control. And wisdom and knowledge lost. Lost credentials of value today. Wisdom and knowledge shall be the stability of thy time. And strength of salvation. The fear of Yahweh is his treasure. And we dealt with that last time and felt the glory of that. The strength of salvation that was involved in that. And therefore that is the matter, my dear brothers and sisters, that we must unite our lives with. There's a strength of salvation in that. Never mind the prevailing winds that change around with men's thoughts. There is in our salvation a strength, a consistency. And it's going on to wisdom and knowledge that will be the stability of a very great and wonderful period of the earth's habitation, the millennial reign of Christ on earth. And then it slipped from that scene in verses 5 and 6. I just remembered I should have turned this on. I wonder if they'll have these things in the kingdom. Wouldn't it be wonderful if they didn't have electronics in the kingdom? Absolutely glorious. Verses 7 to 9, Judah's utter dismay. So we slip from verses 5 and 6, this exultant picture of the future, to Judah's utter dismay. Behold, their valiant ones shall cry without. Their heroes, their valiant ones. They're outside of the city, but they're powerless against this marauding power that is spreading all through the land. The cruel and voracious Assyrians. There's an attempt made at diplomacy. The ambassadors of peace, however, shall weep bitterly. There is no fruit from words. Assyria just passes them by or makes her agreement and then breaks it. There is no opportunity for a word of diplomacy. Do you remember in the 2 Kings 18 is the verification of that? I'm not sure if we did that last time, did we? You got that note in your margin? 2 Kings 18. I was just trying to work out exactly where we finished last time. 2 Kings 18 verse 16. At that time did Hezekiah cut off the gold from the doors of the temple of Yahweh and from the pillars which Hezekiah, king of Judah, had overlaid and gave it to the king of Assyria. See? Endeavouring to make sort of some payoff to secure some days of peace and quiet, perhaps that he might be wearied in his long adventures away from his land and return, and so Judah might be saved. And his ambassadors, they did try to speak to him when he came close to the city. Verse 17, the king of Assyria sent Tartan and Rabsaris and Rabshakeh from Lachish to King Hezekiah with a great host against Jerusalem. And they went up and came to Jerusalem. Nobody could deal with this. No good having heroes, valiant ones who weren't worth a cracker. Nobody could confront this enormous number of people. And when they came up, they came and stood by the conduit of the upper pool, which is in the highway of the fuller's field. And when they had called to the king, there came out to them ambassadors, people to talk diplomacy, to seek a deal, as it were. Four of them, Eliakim, Shebna, Joah and Asaph, all of eminent office within the city. But there was no security to be found that way. And the fruitlessness of their labours is noted in the last verse of this 2 Kings 18. Then came Eliakim the son of Hilkiah, which was over the household, and Shebna the scribe and Joah the son of Asaph the recorder to Hezekiah with their clothes rent, and told him the words of Rabshakeh. The ambassadors of peace shall weep bitterly. So the strength of heroes is in vain. The well-chosen words of diplomats cannot strike a deal. Verse 8 describes the prevailing sense of desolation and emptiness. The highways lie waste. The wayfaring man ceases. That is to say, because the country is really in the hands of the opposition, of the invader, of the enemy, then people don't go out, do they? They keep in their little homes and keep within their sheds, as it were, so they might not be seen. They wouldn't go and work in the middle of the midday, as it were, because then they might be seen. They might perhaps try and tend what they can around their properties, just when they might not be seen. But they wouldn't go for trips. The highways lay waste, the wayfaring man seeth. There's a similar incident to that in Judges chapter 5. Just gives you the idea of that's behind it. People don't travel, do they, when there's open danger? Judges chapter 5. In the days when Deborah and Barak stood up against the Canaanites, Jabin king of Canaan. In those days, it says in the Song of Deborah, looking backwards, in the days of Shamgar, the son of Anath, in the days of Jael, Judges 5 verse 6, the highways were unoccupied and the travellers walked through byways. That is, they took the odd road that would not be seen. They wouldn't take the principal road. They were too apprehensive to do that because of the presence of the invader. Going back now to Isaiah, he says, he hath broken the covenant, he hath despised the cities, he regardeth no man. What does it mean, he hath broken the covenant? Quickly turn back again, if you would, to the 2 Kings 18. Because it actually tells us, doesn't it, of this understanding that Hezekiah had with Sennacherib, the king of Assyria. In verse 14, and Hezekiah, king of Judah, sent to the king of Assyria to Lachish, saying, I have offended, because he wouldn't pay the duty that was put upon him. I have offended, return from me. That which thou puttest on me will I bear. And the king of Assyria appointed unto Hezekiah, king of Judah, 300 talents of silver and 30 talents of gold. That's an agreement, isn't it? For such I will not invade you. That was a covenant. But it's clearly now been broken. Sennacherib has not only come through the land one way, he's really gone right through the whole of Judah. He's destroying city after city. In fact, it says in this Isaiah 33 and verse 8, it says, he hath despised the cities. Two other quick references. In chapter 1, verse 7, Isaiah early told them that this would happen. Remarkable prophecy. Looking at the picture in the future, chapter 1, verse 7, the prophet had said this, your country is desolate, and they were probably sitting among a country that was doing exceptionally well. He said, your country is desolate. Why? They said, what are you talking about? Never looked better. Everything's in great prosperity. Your country is desolate. Your cities are burned with fire. Your land strangers devour it in your presence. And it is desolate, as overthrown by strangers. It was a very doleful picture that was painted by the prophet. But it came to pass. Chapter 6, verse 11. Isaiah, when he saw the judgment of God and was fearful of it, he said, Lord, how long? And he answered, until the cities be wasted without inhabitant, and their houses without man, and the land be utterly desolate. No, my dear brothers and sisters, I've lived in all my life without any sense of invasion, and it's hard to even appreciate that in any regard, isn't it? You just imagine if an invading power just came sweeping through your country. What a terrible thing. People that have experienced that are never quite the same. European peoples are never the same after those experiences. Terrible things. Well, this was being said to a people who considered themselves to be the people of God, settled upon the land which God had by covenant given to Abraham. And therefore it was irreversible. They were there and settled. what's Isaiah saying? Could this happen to us? Why, this is the temple. The temple of Yahweh are these. Could this happen? He hath despised the cities. And he did. In this prison, which is referred to as Sennacherib's prison, it's amazing some of the things, you know, they found last century about Assyria. You know, for many years, the higher critics said Assyria never really existed. They said all this business about Assyria in the Bible, it never even existed. Show me an element of Assyria. Where's any evidence of Assyria at all? And you couldn't point to anything. There wasn't anything in all the world that said Assyria ever existed, apart from the Bible, you see. And you know, they found a prison like this. All sorts of things. Magnificent array of things they found about Assyria in that very same century that the higher critics arose. Chance? Sitting in the dust all those years? And up comes the higher critics, and out of the earth the evidence is dug. This is what it said. This is Sennacherib. As for Hezekiah of Judah, who did not submit to my yoke, 46 of his strong-walled cities, it's exactly what the prophet said would happen, as well as innumerable small cities in their neighbourhood, I besieged with scaling ladders, siege engines, infantry breaches, mines and tunnelling, and I conquered them. What an incredible fellow. Would you want to go to another country, 500 miles by foot or more, and start doing all those things? I besieged with scaling ladders, siege engines, infantry, breaches, mines and tunnelling. And you're in another person's country and your wife and children are all way back home. You see, the Assyrians loved battle. They loved it. They sometimes described the Assyrians went to a battle like a man would go to a feast. They loved it. Himself I shut up like a caged bird in his royal city of Jerusalem. But he doesn't say he took him, does he? Because he didn't take him. But he did indeed bind him up like a caged bird. There he was, smack bang in the middle of that city, and everything else around was gone. And that was the last vestige of life and hope. I threw up earthworks against him, and whoever came out of the city gates was made to pay for his crimes. Those of his cities which I had plundered, I cut off from his land and diminished his land. I diminished his land. You see how that comes out in the record towards the end of tonight. I increased his former tribute and exacted a yearly tax in acknowledgement of my sovereignty. But as for Hezekiah, he was intimidated by the splendour of my power and the Erbi and his best mercenary troops, which he had brought in to strengthen his royal city of Jerusalem, deserted him in terror. So runs Sennacherib's lively and fascinating description of the stirring events during his Palestine campaign in 701. Little word of the prophet, wonderfully confirmed by the findings of archaeology. It says then in verse 8, he regardeth no man. The word for man there is in the plural, and it's Enoshim. And you probably remember that there are three words often translated man. And what's this one mean? What does Enosh mean? Weak man, yes. It stands for mortal man. Where in Job, is it Job 14? It asks the question, Job 14, is it verse 9, about mortal man. Shall he be just before God? That's the word Enosh, isn't it? So Enoshim means weak ones. He regardeth no man, but to him the whole lot of them were but weak ones, weaklings. Now is that true? It's very true, isn't it? Turn back again to the king's record. It's lovely to correlate these little passages together, isn't it? We have our readings in Isaiah 33 around kitchen table. We will be able to make them much more interesting because of all these little cross-references which verify wonderfully the words of the prophet. So in 2 Kings 18, the man in that city, of course, upon whom the hopes of the people rested, was the king, Hezekiah. What did Rabshakeh think about Hezekiah? Thus saith the king, verse 29 of 2 Kings 18, let not Hezekiah deceive you, for he shall not be able to deliver you out of his hand. Neither let Hezekiah make you trust in Yahweh, saying, Yahweh will surely deliver us, and this city shall not be delivered into the hand of the king of Assyria. He belittled even King Hezekiah. Until I come, verse 32, and take you away to a land like your own land, a land of corn and wine, a land of bread and vineyards, a land of oil, olive, and of honey, that ye may live and not die. And hearken not unto Hezekiah when he persuadeth you, saying, Yahweh will deliver you. He wasn't the slightest bit moved by the prowess or abilities or standing or popularity of Hezekiah. He belittled him as he belittled all the others. Second Chronicles chapter 32. This is now Sennacherib himself, his own words. Verse 10, thus saith Sennacherib, king of Assyria, whereon do ye trust that ye abide in the siege in Jerusalem? What's your hope in there? What are you putting your hope in? What do you close the gates for? Why not try and come out and have at least some opportunity to run into the countryside? What do you think you're going to do inside that mountain of stone? Whereon do ye trust? Verse 11, doth not Hezekiah persuade you, not King Hezekiah, is it? Doth not Hezekiah persuade you to give over yourselves to die by famine and by thirst, saying, Yahweh our God shall deliver us out of the hand of the king of Assyria? Hath not the same Hezekiah taken away his high places and his altars, and commanded Judah and Jerusalem, saying, ye shall worship before one altar and burn incense upon it? See him railing against even the king. Verse 16, and his servants spake yet more against Yahweh Elohim and against his servant Hezekiah. And so in the eyes of Sennacherib and Rabshakeh, even the eminent people of Israel were considered just weaklings. He regardeth no man. Swollen in his own achievements, he regarded no man. So verse 9 of Isaiah 33, it then goes to speak about the tragic state of the earth, that is, of the land of Israel. Even the good places are in tragic disarray. The earth mourneth and languisheth. It's the same language as chapter 24, verse 4. Lebanon, glorious Lebanon, lifting up its heights 9,000 feet, snow-capped permanently through the year, crowned with glorious cedars on its heights. Lebanon is ashamed and hewn down. Sharon is like a wilderness. Sharon is the plain that is just south of that pimple on the coast. That's Carmel, isn't it? That points out into the sea. And the plain along the coast that runs down from there is Sharon. Sharon is like a wilderness, and Bashan and Carmel shake off their fruits. Carmel means fruitful place. And Bashan was on the other side of Jordan, but was known because of its good lands. So Lebanon, Sharon, Bashan, Carmel, all of them are in absolute disarray. There is not even any place in that land that is worthy of its former prosperity. Well, it's interesting to note that, in fact, in the 2 Kings 19, those very places are mentioned. Let's go back and just have a little look at that. 2 Kings 19. Just as we're turning to it, if you think about those four places, none of them are in Judah, are they? Lebanon, Bashan, Carmel, and Sharon. None of them are in Judah. Why then are they brought in? It can't mean that God was, I don't think, was meaning that those lands in themselves had been denuded. That was not the main point. What it was saying is the very best has gone. Because in actual fact, those four were not really part of the territory of the kingdom of Judah. They were all outside. But Lebanon, we know, is used many times as a symbol of the ultimate glory of Israel, of the very best of Israel. So also, therefore, Bashan, Carmel, and Sharon are used in that same sense. But it could also have some literal application, because when Assyria came down, he came down through the coasts. He took the area of Tyre and Sidon first. So he did come through that way. And a great army like that, coming through the land, of course, has many resources to find. It strips the place of wood, doesn't it? They use vast quantities of wood for their various works of war. You might have read about, for example, when Napoleon went through Europe, it just cut a swathe of destruction. They would drain every vestige of good out of that land as they went through. So also the great armies of Europe in the First and Second World Wars. So there would have been something of that too as he came down through Lebanon, through Carmel, and through Sharon, and down onto Jerusalem. But in the 2 Kings 19, where we were going, in the 2 Kings 19, verse 23 and 24, it here describes, this is God now giving the message back through Isaiah to the desperately worried Hezekiah. These are beautiful words. Whom hast thou reproached and blasphemed, and against whom hast thou exalted thy voice, verse 22, and lifted up thine eyes on high, even against the Holy One of Israel? By thy messengers thou hast reproached the Lord, and hast said, with the multitude of my chariots I am come up to the height of the mountains, to the sides of Lebanon, and will cut down the tall cedar trees thereof, and the choice fir trees thereof, and I will enter into the lodgings of his borders, and into the forest of his Carmel. I have digged and drunk strange waters, and with the sole of my feet have I dried up all the rivers of besieged places. That's the same language, isn't it? The very good places, the prosperous, well-watered places, those of thick and luxurious soil. He says, I've trodden through them all and conquered them and brought them under my banner. And so in a similar way, 33 verse 9 is saying that even the very best places are in a state of mourning. See, what happens too in time of a siege is that in time of rampaging of an enemy army through the land is that people, as I said before, don't till their land. You don't. If you get out there and really worked it hard and you had a beautiful crop of cabbages or lettuce or whatever else it might be, a nice crop of wheat, what's going to happen? You just attract the enemy to your property, don't you? But then if you don't do it, where do you find the food? It's a desperate thing, isn't it? So it's a very difficult thing. Extremely difficult. So the land, even the good parts, languish and their fruits, as it were, shake off. All right, now in verses 10 to 12, we have the divine response. These are beautiful words. Feel the power of them, my dear brothers and sisters. Now will I arise. Enough, saith Yahweh. Now will I be exalted. Now will I lift up myself. Feel the power of that? Three times does he state his affirmation, his determination that he will no longer wait. This power which he brought down, its words have come into his ears. There is such a swelling arrogance that he will no longer bear with that. He brought him down in judgment against his people, but enough is enough. And now he will teach that nation that he has used for his purpose and used him as a weapon. He will teach him who really moves the power, who has the authority. It's very similar to chapter 10. Do you remember in chapter 10 we had that, almost comical, it's put in the most interesting way. Chapter 10, verse 15. Speaking of the same power and how God used him. Verse 12 first. Wherefore it shall come to pass that when the Lord hath performed his whole work upon Mount Zion, see, this work of judgment, when he's performed that, I will punish the fruit of the stout heart of the king of Assyria and the glory of his high looks. Shall the axe, verse 15, that I have used against Israel, Shall the axe boast itself against him that heweth therewith? He says, Assyria was just an axe. And I came along and I took hold of that axe and I used that to hew down a tree. But the foolish axe thinks that he did it himself. He said, it was me who did that. I used that weapon for my purpose. Why should that axe therefore be boasting as though it did it in its own right? Or shall the saw magnify itself against him that shaketh it? As if the rod should take itself against them that lift it up, or as if the staff should lift up itself as if it were no wood? Therefore shall the Lord of hosts, send among him fat ones, leanness, and under his glory he shall kindle a burning like the burning of a fire. And that's exactly the same thing that we have here in chapter 33, verse 11. The fire of divine vengeance is going to rectify the situation and cause Assyria too to see that she too is in the control of the great Yahweh of Israel. Ye shall conceive chaff, verse 11. Ye shall bring forth stubble. You will conceive chaff and bring forth as the final fruit of your labours stubble. Your breath as fire shall devour you. Now, that's not the most remarkable verse. What that's saying, isn't it? In the most graphic terms, is that all your labour, and we use that with a double meaning there, don't we? All your labour will go up in a puff of smoke, which you yourself will cause to come upon that which you've laboured for. What is the bringing forth? They conceived chaff and brought forth stubble. Well, as we said before, look at what they did. I mean, if you were one of those soldiers and you'd left the city of Nineveh up there on the river Tigris and come all that way, look at all the cities you'd taken. Every time you went through those cities, you'd go through people's houses and you'd put some of their jewels in your bag, find some of their gold and put it in your bag. So you'd accumulated all this tremendous treasure that you collected from all these cities in Judah and beyond. Right? They had conceived chaff and they would bring forth stubble. They didn't think it was that, did they? They thought it was all the riches of the nations that they'd conquered. And God says, look, it's going to be a fruitless labour. And what's more, it's going to be your own mouth that will burn what you have brought. And it is. Why was it their mouth, that devoured the very fruit that they felt that they had collected from all of those nations? Well, because of their boastings. The 37th chapter, the historical section. We've tried to keep away from these chapters, Brother John, because you're coming through here soon. But chapter 37 puts it very well. This is how they, as a fire, devoured their own fruits. Whom hast thou reproached and blasphemed? 37 verse 23. And against whom hast thou exalted thy voice and lifted up thine eyes on high? Even against the Holy One of Israel. By thy servants hast thou reproached the Lord and hast said, by the multitude of my chariots am I come up to the height of the mountains, the sides of Lebanon, and I will cut down the tall cedars thereof, and the choice fir trees thereof, and I will enter into the height of his border, and the forest of his Carmel. I have digged and drunk water, and with the sole of my feet have I dried up all the rivers of the besieged places. Hast thou not heard long ago, says God, how I have done it? And of ancient times that I have formed it? Now have I brought it to pass that thou shouldest be to lay waste defence cities into ruinous heaps. Verse 28. But I know thy abode and thy going out. He brought him out, he will take him back. And thy coming in and thy rage against me. Because thy rage against me and thy tumult is come up into mine ears, therefore will I put my hook in thy nose and my bridle in thy lips, and I will turn thee back by the way which thou camest. And that's what happened. It was his own mouth, wasn't it? The fire that came forth of his own breath that destroyed Sennacherib. If he had have come and acknowledged that he was working under the hand of God, he would have been able to go back in peace with his army to his land. But he raised up with his own mouth his voice against God, and God said, right, I'll strip you of everything you've got. And they accumulated all that wealth and they left it on the sides of Jerusalem like a remarkable booty. More than Hezekiah ever gave, ever thought to give. The king of Assyria was left around that city in vast quantity. They conceived chaff and they brought forth stubble, and they lost it because of their own boastings. Your breath as fire shall devour you. What a remarkable statement. Absolutely incredible statement. How God saw it so clearly. Verse 12. And the people shall be as the burnings of lime. As thorns cut up shall they be burned in the fire. Well, we know what happens with thorns when they're put under the fire. These young lads, we used to love to get thorns, didn't we? And put them under the fire. They really go sparkle and splash in all directions. Brilliant to see thorns under the fire. It's similar to chapter 30. Chapter 30, verse 27. Behold, the name of Yahweh cometh from far, burning with his anger, and the burden thereof is heavy. His lips are full of indignation, his tongue is a devouring fire. His breath is an overflowing stream, shall reach to the midst of the neck. Verse 33. For Tophet is ordained of old, yea, for the king it is prepared. He hath made it deep and large. The pile thereof is fire and much wood. The breath of Yahweh like a stream of brimstone doth kindle it. So, as the thorns cut up, shall they be burned in the fire. What does it mean when it says in the previous phrase, and the people shall be as the burnings of lime? The word lime is the word sid. And it's from that word, Hebrew word sid equals lime. What is lime? Were you chemists? What's lime? Yes, Phil? Chalk? Calcium carbonate. I think it's actually calcium hydroxide. For the hydroxide. You thought that was cordial? Well, I hope you don't get into beverages. It has a most terrible effect upon human flesh. I don't know if you can remember reading about the bombing in World War II. Sometimes they fell upon convents, and in would come the fire brigades and what have you, and they'd find these places, pits of lime. And in those pits of lime they'd find little bodies that were intended to never be known. But just because the bombs landed there and the fire brigades came in, something that had never been disclosed was revealed. And so on. I remember reading about pits of lime. Because the lime, you see, just dries up the body. Just reduces all the moisture from it. And so here it says, and the people shall be as the burnings of lime. Terrible thought, isn't it? But try and bring that to the real picture in the days of Hezekiah. What did they do with 185,000 people? 185,000 bodies, plus their horses and so on. What are you going to do with it? Terrible, terrible thing. And I'm sure that they would have had to use lime to sort of kill the smell. It would reduce markedly the smell because it would reduce the moisture in all that dead, corrupting flesh. Terrible thought, isn't it? Well, that's the end that came to Sennacherib and all of his boastings. That dared, my dear brothers and sisters, that dared to lift its voice up against the God of Israel and to challenge him as to who did these things. The people shall be as the burnings of lime. And it's from that word SID that we get the word Sodom, which simply means a place of lime. And that's, of course, what really was the end. You know how that in the Hebrew, it's the consonants that are the important part of the word. So it's essentially the same as this word here. All right. It's interesting just to think about Sodom being called Sodom, place of lime. I wonder why it was, because, all right, if you went there today, you'd say that, because it looks like that. But in the days when it had its name, in the days of Abraham, it was exceedingly beautiful, wasn't it? Like the Garden of Yahweh, it says in Genesis 14. There must have been some pit or something of lime, I don't know. But it was a prophecy, really, wasn't it, of what was to happen because of its iniquity. In the early days, it was a place not of lime, really, but a place of great beauty, garden quality. All right, now verse 13 and 14. We have an appeal to all nations to hearken. An appeal to all nations to hearken. Why to all nations? There's a warning coming. Hear ye that are far off what I have done. And ye that are near, acknowledge my might. The whole world, far off and near, were going to comprehend and take stock of their own lives in what God was going to do in this vast theophany, this vast manifestation of God and of his power. They were going to take notice. And you know, they did indeed do that. History showed that that was true. In the 2 Chronicles 32, here's a crossroads of great significance to that passage of Scripture. In 2 Chronicles 32, speaking of how God saved Hezekiah and destroyed Sennacherib, thus Yahweh saved Hezekiah and the inhabitants of Jerusalem from the hand of Sennacherib, king of Assyria, and from the hand of all other, and guided them on every side. And many brought gifts unto Yahweh to Jerusalem and presents to Hezekiah, king of Judah, so that he was magnified in the sight of all nations from henceforth. Hear ye that are far off what I have done. And they did. And they brought gifts to King Hezekiah. And no doubt they worshipped Yahweh, the God of Israel, when they saw this vast devastation, because it was not only a blessing, was it, just to Israel, but to all the world. Would you want such a marauding, cruel, vicious power to be just running amok in all the world? Terrible force was let loose. Well, there was great rejoicing when that power had now been restrained and destroyed. Ye that are near, he says, acknowledge my might. Isn't that interesting? If you were sitting there listening to Hezekiah, you'd sort of feel as though the scope of his thoughts was way out there, and then all of a sudden he says, and ye that are near, acknowledge my might. You can't listen to a theme of judgment. None of us can today, can we? We cannot listen to a theme of judgment without taking stock of our own selves in that circumstance. Yahweh is not a respecter of persons. If he's going to do that against the Gentile world, and we're standing right in the wake of it, then it has an implication to us, doesn't it? He's not a respecter of persons. Won't turn the lamp and say, oh, Christa Delvin, okay, through you go. Will he? He's not a respecter of persons. His warning, therefore, is to all, to them that are far off and those that are near. You know how those terms far off and near are used, don't you? I think I've referred to that before. Quickly then, 57:19. Nice to link these up together, because this is New Testament work as well, isn't it? 57 verse 19, I create the fruit of the lips. That is the message that is to be said. Peace, peace. To him that is far off and to him that is near, saith Yahweh, and I will heal him. Near and far off. What did he mean?
turn our Bibles. Let's have an apostolic commentary on that statement. Can't have it better than that, can we? In Ephesians, therefore, in chapter 2. Ephesians chapter 2 and verse 12, verse 13. But now in Christ Jesus, ye who sometimes were far off are made nigh by the blood of Christ. For he is our peace. Far off, nigh or near, and peace. Peace, peace. To him that is near and to him that is far off. And so you can see the elements are there in verses 13 and 14. And consequently, verse 17 of Ephesians 2, he quotes the passage. See how absolutely essential it is to go home and mark those passages with red ink. We must have our cross quotations, mustn't we, marked up in our Bible, because they're just so helpful. Apostolic comment on the very passage. Back to 57:19, back to 33, and verse 14, verse 13, and we've got the whole story all linked up together in a very interesting way. So you're going to run home and get your quotes marked up, then? Good, that's right. Verse 14. Ye that are near, acknowledge my might. The sinners in Zion are afraid. Fearfulness hath surprised the hypocrites. Who among us shall dwell with the devouring fire? Who among us shall dwell with everlasting burnings? Those two questions are the questions that came into the sinners in Zion and the hypocrites in Jerusalem. You see, despite all that would happen, even within that city, whilst many faithful people had come into that city because they knew that was going to be the city of salvation, and because Isaiah was there and Hezekiah was there, God's king and his prophet, yet nevertheless there were still among them people who didn't deserve to be in that city. And they thought it was marvellous to look out there and see that God would destroy the Assyrians, and he did. But when they went back to their homes, they thought to themselves, look at the awe-inspiring glory and power that God has shown just there, just next to myself. And he slew them that I might have life. But I've been in my home, I've been in my family, I've been in my private life, I've been a crook and a thug. I've been cruel and vindictive. I've been unintending to the things of God. And he knew he was a hypocrite. He'd enjoyed the salvation, but now he realized that God was right alongside him. And as he had brought that destruction against that great host, so he could also against the sinners in Zion and the hypocrites. Woe betide that they should continue in that life. So the message of salvation, or the lesson of so great a destruction, was not only to the nations at large afar off, but it was also to those who were nearby, the Shebna class. Remember chapter 22? That had made themselves an eminent position in the very times of this drama. So those littered thousands of bodies were a tremendous lesson to those who were in that city, as they will be again in the future. Chapter 66. A lesson for the whole world and for us now. Who can dwell with the everlasting burnings, with the perpetual judgment of God, that once it's given, that is final, and its effects are everlasting? It burns continually because of that, because its effects are everlasting. In Isaiah chapter 66, verse 23, it shall come to pass that from one new moon to another, and from one Sabbath to another, shall all flesh come to worship before me, saith Yahweh, and they shall go forth and look upon the carcasses of the men that have transgressed against me. For their worm shall not die, neither shall their fire be quenched, and they shall be abhorring unto all flesh. Knowing the judgments of the Lord, says Paul, we persuade men. And therefore, when they saw that, they were persuaded for themselves and for others to walk and speak correctly. There was the question, who could dwell with such a devouring fire? They felt something like Peter did, perhaps, when he was out there in the Sea of Galilee, and the Lord came and said, cast your net here, and they've been going all night, and they did, and the net was full of fishes, remember? And Peter didn't start counting the fish, he was completely overcome, and he came up to his Lord and he said, depart from me, Lord, for I'm a sinful man. He got the point, didn't he? He'd been so close to a divine miracle that he felt the power and the implications of that miracle. And so all of the inhabitants of Jerusalem must have felt like that. When the place was shaking and the storm came over that place and the lightning was shooting down from heaven above and that great host was being destroyed by the angel of Yahweh, those inside must have been weighing up their own life with fear and dread. Who can dwell with the everlasting burning? Well, says God, this is what I want. Verse 15. It's not impossible. I'm not asking something unreasonable. He that walketh righteously and speaketh uprightly. Righteousnesses. He uses his legs the right way that I've given him. He uses his mouth for righteousness. He despises the gain of oppressions. You cannot put a bribe in his hands. He shaketh his hands from holding of bribes. He will be no partner to violence and murder. He stoppeth his ears from hearing of blood. And he will not be in fellowship with evil. He shutteth his eyes from evil. I think those words are tremendous, my dear brothers and sisters. They're not impossible, are they? God's not asking unreasonable things. But I do feel the implication of that verse very strongly in our day, don't you? People don't care a fig about talking about evil. It's all joke today. It's all just joke. You talk about evil, you can joke about evil. You don't have to do righteously. You can be crooked at work. What's wrong with saying the wrong things? Or putting people off, or telling a pack of lies. What's wrong in sport to cheat? Or in daily life to cheat? What's wrong with that? If you go out in the streets today, people are doing that just freely today. That all comes back to us, doesn't it? Because we're living in a totally different calling than what the society is all around us. To keep our ways true and right. To walk righteously. Never mind about whether someone else is fraudulently obtaining wealth that they shouldn't. Or that they're telling lies to obtain this or that. Never mind. When people come up and talk to us about stories that are really a bit murky about, you know, business dealings, what do we do? Go along with it? Laugh it off? That's what the world is doing. But we cannot go down that lane, my dear brothers and sisters. God did not want that. He would not tolerate that. They had to stand true for what was true. They had to stand with what was decent. They had to stand against violence and about fair dealing. And he still requires that of us today. That we do not be compromised by the society in which we live. We hold on to integrity in all of our daily living. So we use our legs, our hands, our ears, our eyes. We use those for the cause of righteousness. Impossible? Wasn't unreasonable calling at all. Who shall dwell with the everlasting burnings? When Armageddon falls upon the latter-day Russian, and there's a vast horde all over the mountains of Israel, and they're going to bury that in another place, and the world's going to come and see that. But who will dwell with the everlasting burnings? People that have those qualities of verse 15. Then in a degenerating age, they clung hold and would not let go of decency and righteousness, of the eternal ways of God. Who shall abide the day of his coming? Well, those who do these things. And then in verses 16 and 17, he goes on to describe very beautiful results the blessings, the rewards of the righteous who do those things. This man shall dwell on high. His place of defence shall be the munitions of rocks. Bread shall be given him, his waters shall be sure. There's a lot of thought involved in that. We're in Jerusalem and the siege is becoming harder and harder upon us. What happens in time of siege? What happens in time of latter-day ways of life? Men grab, don't they? They become less and less patient. They grab. Everybody's grabbing today. That's why the world has got enough for them. They grab and grab and grab, and no limit is there for mankind. So the poor world gets poorer because the resources of the world have been grabbed and grabbed more and more. That's exactly what happened in the siege, even far more. Whatever was still there, people would then secure for their own benefit. And they do it by violence, they do it by stealth, they do it by lying, by stealing, by every cause of dishonesty. Look at AD 70, when the Jews had that city, and the Romans were about them. It was absolutely intolerable what happened in that city. Same kind of things would tend to happen. And they'd hear Isaiah saying, "He that walketh righteously, he that despiseth the gain of oppression," and it would arrest them to stay with decency, to stay with integrity of behaviour. That man, then, says God, shall dwell on high. And it's interesting that Shebna had cut himself out in the rock of the temple, it seems. He cut himself out a little dwelling there, hadn't he? Chapter 22, remember that? Chapter 22, verse 16. To Shebna. "What hast thou here, Shebna? And whom hast thou here, that thou hast hewed thee out of sepulchre here, as he that heweth him out of sepulchre on high, and that graveth an habitation for himself in a rock?" A secure and lofty place Shebna had made for himself. And God says, "I'm going to get hold of you, and I'm going to toss you to Babylon like a ball. You'll just roll and be skittled out, as it were." But the man who puts his feet upon right place, in all the pressure of those times, like our times, and does not yield to the behaviour and approach of our present society, who, loving God, holds on to his ways, he shall dwell on high. He'll be the Eliakim of the future. His place of defence shall be the munition of rocks. And he'll never run out of the essential requirements that are needed in the siege. Bread shall be given him, his waters shall be sure. What beautiful things they are. You see, he had his rock, didn't he? In the 26th chapter. Here was his rock. "In that day shall this be sung in the land of Judah. We have a strong city. Salvation will God appoint for walls and bulwarks. Trust ye," verse 4, "in Yahweh forever. For in Yahweh is the rock of ages. He will give him a place on high." And you know, a little bit later on, Isaiah fills that out a bit more. In his 58th chapter, it's not limited, of course, to the times of Hezekiah. Of course it's not. It goes on to our times. And in the 58th chapter, in verse 14, he says, "If you find not your own pleasure on the Sabbath, nor speaking thine own words, then shalt thou delight thyself in Yahweh. And because of that, you're in a higher place, aren't you? And I will cause thee to ride upon the high places of the earth. He shall dwell on high, with God, as it were." Not literally above the earth, of course, but he is with God, and therefore in that sense, in heavenly places in Christ Jesus, as the Apostle Paul will put it in Ephesians chapter 2. Geographically, he's upon earth. But his security and his citizenship is with God in a high and unassailable place. You know, it's right back in Deuteronomy that expression was first used. got nothing to do with geography. Everything to do with the sense of the passage. The status of the individual who is with God in that circumstance. Deuteronomy 32, verse 13. 12 to bring us in. So Yahweh alone did lead him, and there was no strange God with him. Deuteronomy 32, verse 13. He made him ride on the high places of the earth, that he might eat the increase of the field. So Isaiah's expression in 58, verse 19, is really Moses' expression. He's borrowed it from Moses. But when we take that into the New Testament, and we think about that in our own times, my dear and sisters, in our own terms, it's Ephesians 2, isn't it? You hath he quickened, he hath quickened us together with Christ, by grace are ye saved, and hath raised us up together, and made us sit together in heavenly places in Christ Jesus. Ephesians 2, verse 5 and 6. What the Apostle Paul says there, where he's speaking about taking Gentiles and incorporating them into the commonwealth of Israel, to dwell in the high places of Jacob, see? It's just an expansion of the same thing. Gentiles too can come into that security. All right, verse 17 of our beautiful 33rd chapter, verses 17 to 20, I've entitled "The Vision Splendid," and it is a very beautiful picture. Thine eyes shall see the King in his beauty. They shall behold the land that is very far off. We could spend an hour on that, couldn't we? What does it mean, thine eyes shall see the King in his beauty? Well, there was a time when he never had beauty. In the 53rd chapter, it speaks of that, doesn't it? The echo was first to Hezekiah and then to the Lord Jesus. He shall grow up before him as a tender plant, as a root out of dry ground. He hath no form nor comeliness. And when we shall see him, there is no beauty. When we shall see him, there is no beauty that we should desire him. Then it says, thine eyes shall see the King in his beauty. So he's going to be marvellously transformed. The crown of thorns will be taken away. The back that was ribbed by the whips of the Romans, that will be healed, and he will be there in a king in all of his majesty, all of his comeliness, the Son of God in all of his excellence and majesty. Thine eyes shall see him then, when he's gone through the vale of tears and become the King all glorious. You shall see the King in his beauty. When the other great king of Assyria, remember those passages from our previous class, has gone. This king now has come from obscurity and is glorious to behold. They shall behold the land that is very far off. Literally a land that stretches afar. What's the idea of that? When you looked out of Jerusalem in the days of Hezekiah, all you saw was a barren countryside. And when you saw the Syrians came, all you saw was just a trampled down, fearful panorama. Absolutely fearful. But when this king reigns on high and Zion has been exalted and the panorama spreads out, it's just going to be mile upon mile upon decades of miles, stretching out in the distance. Where is the limits of this empire? There are no limits. From east to west, north to south. This is a limitless empire. They shall see, behold the land that is very far off. You know that grand thought of when you have a vantage point and you see the spreading out of the land. It's an elevating thought, isn't it? There are places that we remember in our life, isn't it? Mangler's Hill looking out over Barossa Valley. There's something exultant about the whole concept of being elevated there and seeing it spread out in front of you. Well, that's what Jerusalem's going to be like. Men will go to that height and they'll look out, and it just seems to be spreading out endlessly in all directions. A glorious panorama. A panorama that, of course, in fact, never ends but goes right round the world. And as that vista is viewed by the saint in the future, he will look back and think to himself, thine heart shall meditate terror. That is to say, your mind will muse on the terror that was in the past. Where's the Assyrian? He's gone. There was an application, of course, in Hezekiah's. He'd gone. Finished. Hezekiah's administration was gathering. The increase of his power. There shall be no end. And it was now happening. He was like a type of Messiah. And things were growing in all directions. 3 years later, the land was full of all kinds of wonderful produce. Where is the terror? It's gone. This is a different time. God has transformed this land and this capital. Where is the scribe? Where is the receiver, the man who received our taxation? The cruel Assyrian that exacted from us the terms of our commitment to him? There is no reparations. There is no talents of gold and silver going to the coffers of Nineveh. Where is he that counted the towers, searching our strength? All around is a pervading sense of peace and tranquility, prosperity and majesty. Thou shalt not see a fierce people, a people of deeper speech than thou canst perceive. Foreigners. Imagine being out listening to a group of people outside your city and they're all yappering and yelling to each other with pride and prowess and you can't understand a word that they're talking about. And their only reason to be there is to cut off your heads. That's how it was before. But you'll muse upon that. So this, the whole thing is transformed. There's no longer the foreigner in my land. Of a stammering tongue that thou couldst not understand. In place of that, the eyes that saw the king in his beauty, they look upon Zion, verse 20, the city of our solemnities, of our special set feasts. Thine eyes shall see Jerusalem a quiet habitation, a tabernacle that shall not be taken down. Not one of the stakes thereof shall ever be removed, neither shall any of the cords thereof be broken. But there the glorious Yahweh will be unto us as a place of broad rivers and streams, wherein shall go no enemy galley with oars, neither shall gallant ships pass thereby. What's that speaking about? Jerusalem's not a place of waters, of lakes, and rivers, is it? It's up there in the mountains. What's it portraying, my dear brothers and sisters? Well, a place of springs and waters is a place of beauty and prosperity and pleasantness. A highway, it says in verse 7 of chapter 35, the parched ground should become a pool, and the thirsty land springs of water. And so in that sense, you see, Yahweh has become to them a place of broad rivers and streams. His blessing is all upon them and around them. They are bathed, as it were, in all the blessings that he has brought to this city by this king that he has appointed. And there will be no opposition, which is here, as it were, symbolized by a galley with oars. The ships of the nations, those that might have been employed by Sennacherib when he came down through Tyre and Sidon, and he used the Phoenician boats to then come against Judah and Jerusalem. There will be no offending power when God clothes this place with verdure and pools of water. There will be no offender. There will be no enemy. For Yahweh is everything in government. He is judge, he's lawgiver and king. That's the three elements of a government. In a government, you have the parliament that makes the laws. You have the administration, the president of America. He administers the laws. He doesn't make them. He administers them. And you have the judge who's above those. And if something happens in the administration of those, he's the ultimate point of reference. But in this administration, Yahweh's everything. He's the judge. He's the lawgiver. He's the king. See verse 17, the king. Verse 22, the king. The chapter is focusing now upon this glorious king, this Lord Jesus Christ, and all the solemnity and majesty of his power. When the great northern host has been destroyed. Looked at in verse 23 as though it was a great ship that came a-founding, that foundered and was not able to get its tacklings together, was not able to strengthen its mast. It couldn't even spread its sail. It came and it foundered. And all that it had gathered together in its hulk was then enjoyed by those it came to destroy. Then is the prey of a great spoil divided. The lame take the prey. A glorious thought that is. There were people on crutches, as it were, that hobbled out of that city, faithful men and women, little kiddies with them. And they ran out into the camp of the Assyrians, and there was all the weaponry, the swords, and all the things that they had used to destroy many nations. Little children and lame men and women were going there and plucking the riches from their tents. Maher Shalal Hashbaz. Hasten the spoil and hasten the prey. And out the city, out the gates of the city, those people would have come, wouldn't they? However they could have come. And rejoicing in this incredible victory that God had given them. And that's how it's going to be for us, isn't it? When God picks up a very small people that are faithful and true to the end and will not change in their ways. They know him, they love him, they believe in what he stands for, and they will not change in their ways. He will destroy that latter day Assyrian upon the mountains of Israel, and he will cause that humble people that would not concede to the way of the Gentiles but were faithful unto the end. He'll give to them a place of honour with the new Hezekiah that God will strengthen and found at that time. Thank you.